Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to take a look at the myriad of problems we're facing, the perfect storm, and for many of us, in our entire lifetimes, we've never faced anything even commensurate what we're dealing with now. As an example, and my guest, Danny Sheehan, will be going into this in some depth in a few moments. But this is just according to today's news. For example, we have nearly one half of all Americans are now facing poverty. That's according to Paul Buchheit in Common Dreams. Quote, the pandemic has caused chaos in the American job market, but you wouldn't know it from free market groups who insist that we will just be fine. Will we? According to the latest studies, almost 41% of businesses that have closed will not be able to reopen. That's a huge number when you consider that more Americans work for small businesses than all of the Fortune 500 companies or the federal government combined. So that means a lot of people are not only not going to have a job, whole careers will be challenged. Think of the restaurant business. It will probably be one of the worst hit. Think of all the people that work in that business, even seasonally. So we're looking at something we're ill-prepared to deal with. And yet the major corporation banks, they always get bailed out. Then we take another look here. This is from the Wall Street Journal today, from Paul Reichert. And it says, the Great American Shale Oil and Gas Massacre. Bankruptcies, defaulted debts, worthless shares, collapsed prices of oil and gas. Quote, the Great American Oil Bust started in mid-2014 when the price of crude oil benchmarked began to a long decline from over $100 a barrel to briefly minus $37 a barrel in April 2020. Bankruptcies of U.S. companies in the oil and gas sector started piling up in 2015. In 2016, the total amount of debt listed in these filings was $82 billion. Bankruptcy filings continued with smaller dollar amounts of debt involved. In 2019, the shakeout got rougher. And this year promises to be a banner year as larger oil and gas companies with billions of dollars in debt collapsed after having wobbled through the poor years of the oil bust. The 44 bankruptcy filings in the first half of 2020 among U.S. exploration and production companies is the worst that we've ever seen. So now we have the Great American Oil Bust. And think of all the hundreds of thousands of jobs, well-paying jobs, by the way, frequently 100 to 150,000 a year. Those are gone, the vast majority, and they won't be coming back. And then think of all the gas hydrofracking. That was the big bonanza. Well, the company that started that bonanza in Delaware bankrupt. So now what we have is we have hundreds of billions of debt in just that sector. We have trillions of dollars in debt in the general sector. We have people not able to pay for food because their credit card bills have been maxed out and no one is relieving them. No one's helping them. There's been no effort by Democrats or Republicans in Congress to seek relief by lowering the interest rate to something like 2%. Instead, they are compounding interest. So we're going to see a massive amount, millions upon millions of bankruptcies this year. On top of that are people's health. We're the sickest nation in the world per population. And that says a lot. So we have ill health. We have a pandemic that has been mismanaged and we've been lied to about much of it. We have had people exploiting these crises. We've had unemployment at record numbers, and yet nothing has been done to correct the underlying problems, but a lot of people are benefiting from it. In comes Danny Sheehan to unravel all this, to tell us the following. First of all, Danny, nice to have you with us today.
Terrific, Gary. Thank you so much.
Danny, here is my question for you, please. And this is really a history lesson. Right now, there is so much political division. There is so much animus between different groups that nobody wants to cooperate. How did we get here? Something is not being discussed anywhere in the media or in any discussion that I'm aware of, and that is the people who are really the most powerful people in the world working quietly behind the scenes. They're never going to be affected by who's marching in the streets. They're not affected by how good or bad an economy will be, which industries succeed or fail, because they have so much wealth and they are so diverse and they're so politically keen on winning and holding on to their power. Could you give us a history lesson, please, on the deep state? Because no one's even mentioning the deep state in connection to anything that's happened in the last 30 to 40 years. And yet the deep state has been present through all different administrations and through who got bailed out in the banking crisis. It wasn't the average person. And who got bailed out in the COVID crisis. It wasn't the average person. And who is really the master puppeteer behind everything? And there's no one in America who knows as much as you do, because you're one of the nation's most important and influential constitutional public interest lawyers. You also spent 45 years digging into the background of who caused the crisis. You were the one who green-lighted the Pentagon Papers and the Watergate break-in and Iran-Contra and the Silkwood murder case. You've given us the deeper view, the darker side of our society that nobody even knows exists. So could you give us that history lesson now, please?
Yes, Gary. Yes, thank you. What we're facing right now is sort of the current manifestation of a long simmering problem here in our country, and that is right from the very founding of our country in the colonies. The people who instigated the revolt against the British crown that was in charge of the colonies. The colonies were, as we all know, initiated by the government and the king in England for economic purposes, to try to exploit the resources, the natural resources, gold and minerals and other resources of the New World. And so the colonies that were set up were these corporations. They were this new thing at that time. A corporation was set up, and it was manned by particular individuals who were business partners, and they came to the New World and established hegemony over a particular region, and then were attempting to try to determine what the particular resources were that were here that could be fed back to England. There arose in the colonies, out of the people that were the leaders of these different corporate colonies, a mercantile class, merchants and business people and financial people. And they were the ones that were offended by King George and his imposition of taxes on the colonies. And these are the men that organized together to revolt against the crown and to establish an independent country here. And as you know, and they declared their independence in 1776. They fought from 1776 to 1781, and finally tossed out the colonial soldiers and government. And they set up originally the Articles of Confederation to allow these 13 different corporate colonies to function individually. But the financial people in those colonies came to realize that they needed to establish a much more thoroughgoing coordination among their activities. They needed to have common weights and measures. They needed a common currency, these things that were needed by the commercial people. And so that they began to gather together and write to each other in these committees of correspondence, and they decided they were going to establish a new government. And it's extraordinarily important for people to remember that at the founding of our United States government, that went on from 1778 into 1789, they held a whole series of these conventions in Philadelphia. And what they did is they came up with a compromise between two different groups. One of them was led by Alexander Hamilton, who was a lawyer that represented, legally represented, a lot of the major commercial businesses, the banking people, the commercial people. And then on the other side, there were the people that are normally referred to as Jeffersonians. They were actually sort of Madisonians under James Madison. And James Madison and Aaron Burr and a number of these other people had all been educated at the College in New Jersey, which later became Princeton. And they studied under this this professor by the name of John Witherspoon, who taught them moral philosophy and moral theology. And they had this belief in this natural law process that believed that individual human beings were endowed by their creator with these inalienable rights, and they began to articulate these. And so there was a tension that was going on between these two coalitions at the founding of the government. And so the United States Constitution is a balance, a sort of a balance between these. The financialists and the Hamiltonians basically prevailed in setting up the original three articles that set up the federal government. The Madisonians and Jeffersonians ended up establishing the Bill of Rights to assert the rights of individuals. And this tension has existed since the very beginning of the colonies. Once the United States government was formed, there's been this dance between these two different groups in the coalition, the mercantilists, the bankers, the financial people, et cetera. And then there are these individualists that believe in individual human rights and the maximization of liberty on the part of each individual, et cetera. And these people have clashed and had different resolutions of their ongoing conflict over the many years, but it ultimately resolved in the Civil War. And the American Civil War was not fought just over slavery. It was really fought over the effort on the part of the industrialists, the urban-based industrialists in the major urban centers in 1861 to 65, basically attempting to establish control over the federal government, to get the instrumentalities of the federal government to function on behalf of the banks and the financial institutions and the commercial enterprises. And the individualists fought back and resisted, and even to the point of withdrawing from the Union over this big fight. But at the end of the American Civil War in 1865, the Union prevailed. The commercialists, the financial banks, and all of these urban centers prevailed, and they then went on this rampage that went on from 1868 all the way to 1898, a 30-year period, not an extraordinary period length of time in history. You know, for example, it was just 30 years ago was 1990. You know, that it was, you know, so back during George H.W. Bush's administration. The Reagan-Bush administration was just 30 years ago. And so that 30-year period in the United States allowed the mercantilists and the bankers and the financial interests to set up a brand new vehicle, a business vehicle, the private shareholder-owned corporation, in which the businessmen, the owners of the assets of a company, were completely immunized against any personal liability. And they set up these corporations to become like separate individuals, and they functioned as individuals, and they were the only entity that was liable for anything that was done by the company. The owners of the assets and the shares were immune. The management of the company was personally immune. The board of directors were personally immune. But just the company had to pay for any wrongdoing they did. This was a terrible formula, because what it did is it set up a vehicle, the sole purpose of which was to maximize the short-term profits for the company and to be able to then share the profits with the shareholders. And this caused this huge period of avarice and greed to prevail. It's called the Fire Baron era, 1868 to 1898, and it culminated in the McKinley administration in 1898, you know, with Mark Hanna coming into power. And what had happened is these corporations began to monopolize entire sectors of the economy. The railroads, the shipping companies, the steel and ironworks, the agricultural industry, the grain storage industries. These corporations began to establish monopoly control over these various sectors of the economy, and they viewed it as perfectly natural that they would utilize the instrumentalities of the federal government to actually meet their own needs. And so they actually began to generate foreign expeditionary forces at the peak of the robber baron era, to the point where, by for example, in 1903, they got a foreign military expedition to go down into Nicaragua, down in Central America, overthrow the democratically elected government on behalf of United Fruit, and there was a major law firm called Sullivan and Cromwell in Washington, in New York City, that actually represented many of the private owners of the shares of these major corporations, and they represented the corporate entity as well. And what they did is they basically seized control of the United States government by bribing members of Congress, paying for their campaigns, bribing members of the United States Senate, paying for their campaigns, putting people into elected office in all the state legislatures across the country. They viewed it as perfectly natural for them to assert their dominion and control over the instrumentalities of the state and of the federal government. And it was these people that basically moved from the robber baron era into the age of American imperialism. And they began to reach out in 1898 to take over all of Cuba and northern South America, Mexico. They began to go out into the Pacific Ocean, and they overtook Hawaii, Guam, and the Philippines. There was this age of American imperialism. Now, all of these things are simply, you learn about these things in even high school history. And they call it the robber baron era, the age of American imperialism, the new industrial revolution. This entire period, these people began to assert complete control over the United States government. And what they did is they formulated business policies and governmental policies that facilitated these corporations engaging in stock sales and gambling and in reckless business ventures that basically brought them to the point in the fall of October of 1929, when the entire economy collapsed. They basically were siphoning the value, the profits out of the business system and using it for personal wealth, building gigantic mansions, having summer homes, and buying all kinds of these new cars, these new automobiles and things. And you had this astonishing opulence on the part of these the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the J.P. Morgan and the Brown Brothers and Harriman. And what they did is they gathered themselves together, these wealthy industrialists, and they formed a private business investment house. It was called Brown Brothers Harriman. And that particular group, they used to come together, about maybe 30 men that were the heads of these major corporate families, and they would determine policy for the United States government, and that's what was happening, and they drove the economy completely into the ground by siphoning the excess value from the production of products into their own personal massive wealth. These people. And what happened is, when the economy totally collapsed, the guy they had in office, the Republican Party in that particular case, it was Hoover, and he was completely oblivious to what was going on. Just kept on saying, well, things are going to get better. The corporations are all going to figure out what to do about this. The banks, we don't need to regulate them. They'll figure this thing out by themselves. Well, it wasn't working. And so Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932, and he began to try to rein in these major corporations, to prohibit them from having interlocking directorates, prohibit them from the banks from engaging in gambling with the money that people had on deposit in the banks, et cetera. And what happened is that group of men, these industrialists, J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller and the Brown brothers and Harriman and these other people, they actually undertook to attempt a military coup against the Roosevelt administration in 1934. They attempted to recruit the commandant of the United States Marine Corps, General Butler, to overthrow the government, because the government was turning on the corporations and attempting to rein them in, to get them under control, because the experience that everybody was having was showing that they were destroying the entire country. They were ravaging all the natural environment. They were poisoning the rivers. They were destroying the lands with their massive coal mining. They had the people basically enslaved. They had young 7-year-old children working, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week in the mines. They had the young women working in these slave shops, these textile mills. We know the history of this whole thing. And this element of about 30 or so major corporate families ran the country into the ground. And when the actual citizens of the United States attempted to mobilize through the administration of Franklin Roosevelt to establish a New Deal, that was the whole thing, was it was going to be a New Deal. It was going to strike a different arrangement between the major business entities in this elite business financial group that had been in power ever since the beginning of the American Revolution. They tried to get them in a box. They tried to rein them in, structure a set of structures that could rule them and regulate them, the National Labor Relations Board, to establish fair labor standards, the Work Project Administration to build up rebuild the environment and to help the people across the country and to employ the people in a way in which they were not enslaved to these individual corporations. So this thing has happened before, and there was this major retooling that went on from basically 1932 all the way up to 1938. In that 6-year period, and I want us to remember, this is like a 6-year period, there was this dramatic set of steps that were taken by the new administration under Franklin Roosevelt to try to recalibrate the entire economy, to bring the people up out of poverty, to bring the people up out of unemployment, to try to salvage the environment that was being poisoned by these major corporations, to get the banking and financial industry regulated so that the owners could make a reasonable profit but not be completely destroying the country. And so that from 1932 to 1938, this entire operation was put together. What these people did, the financial people that were housed in Brown Brothers Harriman, what they did during that period is they reached out and they actually established they started financing Germany after World War One, and they bought stock in the German industry, and they rebuilt the German industry after World War One, and they tried to create Germany in Europe as the bulwark against Bolshevism, against the Soviet Union that had been created at the end of World War One. This major group of people has been operating in the United States, in ever since the founding, basically, of Brown Brothers Harriman, the major private investment firm in which they all work. And work together to coordinate their control over the American government. So we have a situation now where what's going to be necessary, what's happened again, is we've just had another administration that was similar to Herbert Hoover, that was oblivious to what the corporations were doing, what the financial industry was doing to the country, the raping and pillaging of the environment, the generation of global climate change, the driving of the health of the people into the cellar, the major pharmaceutical corporations generating this entire massive drug industry that and taking over the communication systems of the country so that people would watch their half hour to 1 hour of news every night, and one out of every two commercials on the television were all selling pharmaceuticals. And the pharmaceutical drug companies took it over, and the agricultural people took over and started poisoning the food with massive amounts of chemical fertilizers from the oil industry. the oil corporations were engaging in generating major international wars, getting the United States military, for example, to invade the Middle East and occupy the Middle Eastern oil fields. This whole thing has been going on, again, what we've been facing since the end of the Cold War, basically in December 31st of 1991. We've seen the resurgence of the robber barons. That's what's happened, that they've resurged back into power and have taken over the instrumentalities of the government, the major corporations. They were able to get to place their corporate lawyers inside the judicial system through a thing they call the Federalist Society. It's hardcore right-wing reactionary group of lawyers that have ended up now getting appointed to the federal judgeships. This past administration is appointing 236 new federal judges, all from the Federalist Society, that are making rulings all on behalf of the corporations. They've driven our country right into the same state that we were basically in 1932. So that's the situation that we're faced with. And so what we need is we need to have a rising up of the people to try to assemble a new administration here in 2020, a new administration that can be made up of progressives and moderates and liberals and to try to retake the reins of power here in our country, to reestablish a new deal. We've got to have a new deal.
So, Danny, what you're saying, first of all, thank you for a brilliant insight into how we evolved to where we're at today. And the average American is not aware that almost every pandemic, epidemic, war, conflict is backed by people who have a hidden hand in the outcome. And it's always power and control. Money is, I don't believe, their number one objective because they have so much already. It's unfathomable how much these people possess. But talk about the people who benefit no matter who's in office. They frequently cause the internecine conflicts. So one group is always pitted against another, and that gets our attention to the larger problems that we should be faced with and could relatively, I would say not relatively easily, but we could much more easily challenge a problem where we are all working together, like we did with the Marshall Plan after World War II in rebuilding Japan and Europe. But these people don't want that. They want us at each other's throats. Talk about the hidden hand of these super powerful people that whose names are never in the media.
Yes, Gary, the hand is hidden now of these people because at the end of World War II, they actually established an organization, the Central Intelligence Agency, that Robert Lovett, who was a senior partner in Brown Brothers Harriman, this group. And remember, Brown Brothers Harriman, during their halcyon days, the CEO of Brown Brothers Harriman was George Herbert Walker, who is the grandfather of George Herbert Walker Bush. The attorney for Brown Brothers Harriman was Alan Dulles, who was a senior partner in the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. That this group of people that were aligned in Brown Brothers Harriman, what they have done is they have established an institution now in the government, the Central Intelligence Agency. Robert Lovett wrote this major memorandum to Truman at the end of World War II, saying we had to establish a major covert operation that was going to be able to promote the interests of us vis-a-vis the socialists and communists in the world, in the Soviet Union. That what they were doing is they weren't really engaged so much in anti-communism as they were in pro-capitalist, pro-corporate policies of waging covert wars around the world to overthrow governments who would not allow our corporations to get access to their natural resources. This is a very clear operation that they've done. Now, they actually gathered themselves together now in one of the places that has kind of taken the place of Brown Brothers Harriman is this thing called the Council on Foreign Relations. Council on Foreign Relations is a sub-organization of the Trilateral Commission, which was created by David Rockefeller, the senior head of the family of the Rockefeller family. They bring together this group of people, and they range anywhere from now from maybe 200 people, but there are a core of them. There are about 30 to 50 of these men who really call the shots. And what they do is they bring together at the Council on Foreign Relations, they bring together people who are in positions of power in major corporations, in major financial institutions, in both political parties, in all of the major industry in the country, and they sit together. They have a publication that's called Foreign Affairs Magazine. They now have formed about 40 private think tanks, which they fund to the tune of billions of dollars a year, where they formulate policy, and they pull the strings on the elected leaders in both the Republican and Democratic Party. And what we have to do is we have to break the power of these people. We had them cornered in the Iran-Contra case. We caught them engaging in massive drug smuggling, massive political assassinations around the world, foreign leaders. We caught them, we cornered them, but the leadership of the Republican and Democratic Party at that time banded together to try to block the people from the country learning about who these people were. But we caught them. We tried to expose them. The off-the-shelf enterprise, what they refer to as the off-the-shelf, standalone, self-financing, private over-operations enterprise, was actually the enterprise being run governments around the world. And because the people, our people in the country, had managed to impose oversight on the Central Intelligence Agency, which this group of people had created back in 1947, what they did is they tried to move the operation out from under the official control of the Central Intelligence Agency to be able to run independently. And they were aligned with fascists down in South America, the dictators that were running Bolivia and Uruguay and Paraguay and El Salvador and Guatemala. And these are it's important. One of the most important things that people can understand is that this group in Brown Brothers Harriman back in 1924 actually set up a bank, the Union Bank of New York, to finance through its branch office up in the Netherlands in Europe. They financed the rise of the Third Reich, the fascist government in Germany, to actually establish control for the corporations all through Europe. And in the United States, we were in agreement allowing Germany to rise to power there, and we were going to turn our attention westward into the Pacific, you know, to move from having overtaken the Hawaiian Islands and Guam and the Marshall Islands, et cetera. We were on the way into Southeast Asia. The United States corporations viewed themselves as having the responsibility and the right to take over the resources of Southeast Asia, whereas they were going to be working through their ownership of the major corporations in Germany, like IG Farben, the big major chemical and pharmaceutical company, or the Krupp ball bearing companies, the Messerschmitt company. The people who were the 50 families in the Brown Brothers Harriman, they owned a majority of the stock in the major corporations in Germany. And they had structured the German government, the Third Reich government, to basically be able to run Europe through the corporations, and they were refusing to allow the United States to go to war against Germany, even though Germany had not only invaded the Sudetenland and invaded Poland and France and was firebombing England, but the bottom line is that this element in the United States refused to allow the United States to come to the aid of the European countries against Germany. You had the owner of Time magazine and Life magazine writing a major article in Time magazine openly advocating in 1941 the American century, that this was going to be the American century. Let Germany and their corporations run Europe. The United States was going west into Southeast Asia. They had a group they called the China Lobby that was made up of, there's a whole bunch of people, William D. Pauley, the Brown Brothers, all the wealthy people that were members in the private investment firm of Brown Brothers Harriman. This group of people were now operating under the cover of the Central Intelligence Agency. And the first civilian director of the Central Intelligence Agency became Alan Dulles, who was legal counsel for Brown Brothers Harriman. And this group of about 50 super wealthy families who own the stock in all these banks. They own the stock in the banks that make up the Federal Reserve. You know, there are seven major families that own the banks. The Federal Reserve is an actual private banking consortium of these wealthy people. They own the majority of the stock in Goldman Sachs. They own the stock in the different investment companies, the major banks, the Chase Manhattan Bank. What we're looking at is this drive to monopolize control over the environment for their benefit and to manipulate the instrumentalities of our federal government on behalf of the corporations. This came to the head as soon as the Soviet Union dissolved, when Gorbachev signed the release of all the republics on December 31st of 1991. We've talked about this before. There was an immediate set of meetings that started taking place in the George H.W. Bush administration under his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, his deputy, and Scooter Libby and David Addington and Douglas Fife and Elliot Abrams and these people that were in the Defense Department under Dick Cheney. They sat down and they drafted up the 1992 United States Defense Department Policy Planning Guidance document, explicitly calling for a massive increase in the United States military budget that had been rationalized throughout the entire period of the Cold War under the theory that we had to combat communism into the Soviet Union to keep them from taking over the world. As soon as Gorbachev voluntarily withdrew from the Cold War, these people gathered together and proclaimed in a classified document, this 1992 United States Defense Department Policy Planning Guidance document, that they wanted to form a coalition wanted to take unilateral control over the entire world. They wanted to establish the term they used was full spectrum dominance over the planet. And the purpose of this was to maintain their continued privileged access to the strategic raw materials needed by their country. And by that, they mean needed by their major corporations. So the corporations could get access to the raw materials of these other countries around the world and develop them into products and be able to continue making massive amounts of profit. And the point is they've driven us right over the edge again, just like they did in 1932. They almost did it in 2008 with the collapse of the banking system, and now they're doing it again. And what they're doing is they're going to try to take advantage of this economic situation to be able to buy up all of the resources of all of these small businesses all around the country to draw them into the maw of these major corporations so that they can establish monopoly control over the resources. So this is what's happened here. So what we need to do is we need to do something similar to what was done in the New Deal with Franklin Roosevelt between 1932 and 1938. We've got to have a next 6 to 8 year period during which we are able to form a coalition of people in our country to move forward and establish a new New Deal. That's what we really need to have. Now, in the we have to replace the oil and gas industry and the fossil fuel industry with sustainable energy, clean energy. We need to get rid of the major pharmaceutical corporations dominating the health industry in the United States, the massive health insurance corporations that siphon billions of dollars a year out of our people and make the people less and less healthy because it's a business. It's a business to make the people unhealthy by contaminating their food, you know, with pharmaceuticals basically in the fertilizers. They're made by the oil corporations, and they spread it on our food. They contaminate the people. They destroy our immune system. Then they have their pharmaceutical corporations develop vaccines and all kinds of different medications, you know, to try to allegedly fix what they've caused through their domination over the food industry in the country. So the bottom line is we need a new deal, and it has to be green. It has to be based in sustainable energy. It needs to be based in a clean environment. We need to base it on a genuine health providing system and assisting our health of our people, not monetizing our sickness. You know, we have to set up a new regime here in our country. And I think that the any candidate that wants to run for the presidency in 2020, what they have to do is they have to designate who their vice president is going to be, who their secretary of state is going to be, who the secretary of treasury is going to be, who the secretary of commerce is going to be, who's going to be their trade representative. You know, they have to set forth their entire policy that deal in a totally comprehensive way with the economic and environmental problem that we have right now. So that's what we need to do for the next 100 days in our country. We have to all join together to call for anybody who wants to run for the presidency of the United States, whoever they are from, whatever party they're from, who their cabinet is going to be. People who are going to be their designated head of their cabinet need to be out among the people, talking with the people about what needs to be done, finding out what the people need to have, and to start setting up a set of policies so that when they come into office in January of 2021, that they hit the ground running, just like Franklin Roosevelt did. We need a comprehensive reboot of our country. We need a reboot of our economy. We need a reboot of our political process. We need a reboot of our health system. We need a reboot of our agricultural system. We at the Romero Institute right now are drafting. We have a 350-page draft of the California Green New Deal. We have a 50-page outline of what this is. This is dealing with the energy systems, the providing of electrical energy, the transportation systems to have electrical cars. It's dealing with all 13 different sectors. But this is only going to be able to be done in the state of California. What we need to do is we need to have a national plan that is similar to the New Deal. Let's call this a New Deal, so that people understand what we're doing. They understand the scope and scale of what it is that has to be done now. What's facing the United States right now is nothing less than the total demise of the United States as a major player on the world stage right now. Now, many people may think that is not that bad an idea, because for the last 200 years, our entire foreign policy has been designed to assist the major corporations, and so that it's good to have a reset of this to try to get these corporations out of power. But we can't pretend that they've been disempowered by this. As you point out, Gary, these people are laying in the weeds right now. They're laying in the weeds, and they're going to try to use their massive wealth to buy up the resources of all of these small businesses around the country, and they're going to pretend to be the savior of our economy, and they're going to take over the resources of the small businesses, and they're going to try to reestablish the banking system in a way that still redounds to their private benefit. We've got to call these people out. People like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were calling these people out, the insurance people, the health industry, the pharmaceutical industry. They were confronting them. And the Democratic National Committee basically pushed them out to not allow them to be the nominees. But what we have to do now is the people have to rise up, and we have to start demanding fundamental rebooting of our economy, of our health systems, of our agricultural systems, and our governing structures. We've got to eliminate, we've got to get rid of the Electoral College so that we have our the popularly elected candidates get into office. There's a whole series of changes. We need public financing of our elections. We know what these are. We know what these things are. What we need is something like the mandate for leadership that was drafted by the right-wing think tank, the Heritage Foundation. They drafted this for the Reagan-Bush administration that came in 1980.
Okay. Danny, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. But you've given us a lot to think about. You've put it into a deeper, more complete and complex structure. So let us pull back from the arguments. Let us pull back from the divisiveness within our body politic. Let us pull back from all of the microaggression phenomena and all of the identity politics and look at the larger problems we're faced with and what we need in order to unify to correct these together. Danny Sheehan, thank you very much for being with us. Really appreciate it. Just to highlight some of the important issues that Danny Sheehan was discussing, that behind so many of our conflicts, such as the Spanish-American War and the takeover of the Philippines and the invasion of Cuba and Nicaragua and Honduras, right up to the modern day when we're still in Afghanistan, in Iraq, we tried to undermine Assad in Syria and take over Syria. There's always a group of people who are behind this. He suggested the Council on Foreign Relations. What's interesting is if you look at the members of the Council on Foreign Relations, it has all the top media and the journalists, it has top business and corporate leaders. So no matter where you would go with a challenge to, we shouldn't be doing this, we shouldn't be invading countries, we shouldn't be killing off democratically elected leaders because they're not bending to the will of our imperial desires, nobody's there who's a friend to listen. Today we have a perfect storm with the COVID virus. We have a perfect storm with our healthcare system in shambles and more people sick than ever before in American history. We also have a perfect storm in that we're more in debt than ever before and we can never get out of that debt. Now some people thrive on debt, major corporations. Now some of them are going to go under. In fact, some people within the industries I mentioned at the beginning of the show, like the shell industry and the oil industry, the prices are so low and they borrowed everything to keep growing and now they can't service their debt, so they'll go bankrupt. So we have, and that'll lead to more unemployment, including the fact that 51% of all Americans are now deep in debt. They're in poverty. Now think about for a moment. We have a professional class of about 17 million people. Doctors, lawyers, scientists, engineers, professors, those with advanced educations, and generally those in the upper middle class who are making anywhere from $100,000 to $1 million a year. The trouble is that group has been spending every nickel it's made to increase its standard of living. And as a result, it has no backup capital. It has nothing in savings. And it's now stretched. And COVID has closed down a lot of lawyers' offices and closed down a lot of opportunities, but they have not reversed their spending. As a result, now they went from spending what they made to being in debt. So that is a big number, because when you add in numbers of in a family, if you have three people in a family, it's simple math, if you have more or less 17 million people in the professional class, and you have three people per family, you're talking about 51 million Americans. Now put in 10 million millionaires, and let's say two people per family, that's 20, or it's 70 million Americans. Well, 70 million Americans have historically not had to weather any kind of crisis the way the average person does. For example, on the Upper West Side where I live and have my entire adult life in New York, There's a group of people who are wealthy enough that they have summer homes or other homes, and they can flee there and have. So they haven't been in the same quarantine those of us in the city have been. So whatever happens, they realize, gee whiz, I don't even have to go back to the city. Well, what if you're in those cities like New York, which is no longer the city that I grew up in, and it's ruled by a corrupt politic at every level, city council level? They have enormous clout, and the realtors have clout over them. So all the small businesses who are now 41% are going to stay closed. They won't open. They're bankrupt. And then you go up one another level to the state level. State legislators meet on a regular basis with members of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. And they do that at these nice resorts. They'll sit for dinner, and a lobbyist for a major corporation will give a bill, and they'll study the bill, and they'll say, go back to your legislature and pass this as a law. Now, none of these tens of thousands of laws that have come into existence because of this backroom dealing, this quid pro quo, will give you money for your next campaign, but in turn, you make sure these laws pass that protect us and help us, deregulate us. No one has called them out. So you've got your governors who are compromised, your legislators compromised. Everybody is owned by somebody. Everybody has been captured. Big Pharma captures people, military industrial complex, Washington, D.C. captures people. The energy cartels capture them. The food industry captures. So you've got about 15 major types of industries, and they've got tens of thousands of lobbyists. And so then, who exactly is supposed to prevent the next conflict? Who is supposed to see that we get organically grown food and anything genetically engineered is labeled? Who's supposed to start the deindustrialization of changing over from these fossil fuel industries that pollute and cause global warming to ones that do not? Who's looking after our needs? And the answer is no one. Now they'll pontificate and they'll deal in great euphemisms. Barack Obama did, Bill Clinton did, Hillary Clinton promised, George Bush did. They never delivered on anything because they're totally wedded to who's making sure their future is going to be as a multimillionaire. Now it's nothing at all for a person like the Clintons and Obamas to have $100 million plus in assets and income after leaving office. How did they get that? Simple. You deregulate industries, or you give preferential treatment to industries and they give it back. You know, $50,000, $100,000, $500,000 lecture, whatever it is. And you go down there on Wall Street and talk about nothing, but that's the way that they give it back. So we have a government at every level, local, state, and federal, that has been captured. All of our regulatory agencies, the FDA, the USDA, CDC, all captured. Everything at the behest of someone else. So what Danny Sheehan is saying is this. We have to stop believing that if we elect a Democrat instead of a Republican, that everything will be good. It won't. Nothing changes. In fact, it'll be worse. How could it be worse? How could anything be worse than Trump? It'll be the same. Obama selected his cabinet based upon the recommendations of a top executive at Citigroup, Citibank. Well, we weren't told that. That came out in the leaked John Podesta emails. So let us realize that until we withdraw from their media, give up their credit card, stop banking in their bank, stop buying their cheap clothes made in Bangladesh at 14 cents an hour to these women, till we stop reading their magazines, watching their television programs, listening to radio programs, until we get off their grid, then we are enabling them to abuse us. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.